Chapter 8
"The skiff,"
Sam rasped softly.
"Come on."
He slid belly first down the bank and into the water. A quarter mile upstream, Scarface had turned the powerboat into the mouth of another inlet, which the man in the bow was scanning through a pair of binoculars. Sam heard Scarface's voice echo over the water, followed by another voice saying, "Nyet." Great. More Russian heavies. Sam stroked over to where he'd secured the skiff's painter line, quickly undid the knot, then swam back and grabbed the bow cleat. He glanced over his shoulder. Scarface was bringing the powerboat about and turning their way.
"Sam."
"I see them." He wrapped the painter around one fist, then accepted Remy's help up the bank.
"Pull,"
he whispered.
"Pull hard."
Together they heaved on the painter. The skiff's bow bumped against the bank, then began inching up the slope. The powerboat was 300 yards away. The men's attention seemed focused on the opposite shore, but Sam knew that could change at any second. One stray glance, and they were finished.
"Pull, Remy."
Again they heaved back on the painter. Sam spread his legs and dug his heels into the soil, pulling until the tendons in his neck bulged. The skiff's nose appeared over the lip of the bank, but now free of the water and subject to gravity, the electric motor began fighting them. The skiff slipped backward a foot.
"One more good pull," Sam said. "On three. One, two, three!"
The skiff arced up and over the lip and slid on to level ground. In lockstep, Sam and Remy backpedaled, dragging the skiff deeper into the grass.
"Down, Sam."
Remy dropped to her belly, followed a split second later by Sam. They went still, tried to slow their breathing.
"Think we made it?" Remy whispered.
"We'll know shortly. If things go bad, I want you to run as fast as you can. Head for the forest and don't look back."
"No, Sam."
"Shh." The powerboat's engine was growing louder by the second, seemingly headed straight for their spot. Then, Scarface's voice.
"Anything?"
"Nothing. What are they in, anyway?"
"A skiff, about 12 feet long."
"Can't be on this side," the voice said. "There's nothing here. Got to be the other one. Plenty of side channels to hide in there."
"Yeah."
The engine noise began moving off, fading across the water until Sam and Remy could only hear its distant echo. "They've moved into another channel," Sam said, rising to his knees and peeking over the top of the grass. "Yep. Don't see them. They're gone." Remy rolled onto her back and let out a sigh.
"Thank God."
Sam lay down beside her. She laid her head onto his shoulder.
"What do you say?" he asked.
"Stay or go?"
She didn't hesitate. "We've come this far.
Be ashamed to leave the mystery unsolved."
"That's the woman I love," Sam said.
"What?
Reckless and misguided?"
"No. Courageous and determined." Remy sang softly, "You say potato, I say potato."
"Come on, back to work."
Sam spit into his mask, dipped it into the water, then settled it onto his head. Remy stood on the bank, arms on her hips, face etched with worry.
"Just going to have a look around," he assured her.
"I'll save the air in case we can get inside.
This won't happen, but if it shifts in my direction while I'm down there, just start working those ratchet blocks until it tips back. If I don't come up within, say, 4 to 6 hours, you can start worrying."
"Comedian." "Hold the fort, I'll be back." Sam clicked on his flashlight, took a deep breath, and ducked beneath the surface. Left hand extended, he finned downward. Within only a few feet, the algae-filled water turned a deep green, and visibility dropped to only a few feet. Sediment and bits of plant life swirled in the flashlight's beam, leaving Sam feeling like he was trapped inside a nightmarish snow globe. His hand touched something solid, the hull. He kept going, letting his hand trail over the curve of the hull until finally the bottom appeared in his flashlight beam.
The keel was perched atop a jumble of sunken logs, precariously balanced but stable enough that Sam felt a flood of relief knowing the sub wasn't likely to roll over on him. He felt the ache in his lungs turn into a burning, so he finned for the surface.
"Everything okay?" Remy asked once he'd caught his breath.
"Yep. Good news. She's sitting upright, more or less. Okay, going again."
He ducked back under, this time estimating the hull's diameter as he skimmed past it. At the keel, he turned aft. At about the midpoint, he encountered a bracket of some sort jutting from the hull and running lengthwise. For a moment, what he was seeing didn't register on his brain. He'd seen this before, one of the pictures from his earlier research. When the answer came, Sam felt a knot form in his belly. Torpedo rack. He stopped swimming and cast the flashlight along the bottom, seeing it with new eyes. Was one of those seemingly harmless sunken logs something else altogether? He kept swimming aft until his flashlight picked out the tapered cigar end of the sub and jutting from its side a horizontal plane. When he drew even with it, he righted himself and let himself rise alongside the hull until the last piece of the puzzle came into view. Rising from the back of the hull was another tube, about 18 inches tall and about shoulder width in diameter. Entry hatch. Sam popped back up to the surface and stroked over to the bank, where Remy helped him out. He shed his fins and mask and took a moment to gather his thoughts.
"Well?" she said.
"There's a manila folder in one of the duffels. Could you grab it for me?" She was back with it in half a minute. Sam flipped back and forth through the loose pages for a couple minutes, then plucked one of the sheets out and handed it to Remy. "Mulch," she read.
"What in God's name?"
Her words trailed off as she kept reading. Sam said, "Mulch means salamander." It was a class of midget torpedo submarine produced by Nazi Germany in 1944. Built for the Kriegsmarine by A.G. Weser, a company in Bremen, the Mulch was the brainchild of Dr. Heinrich Dräger. Measuring 35 feet long, 3 feet from deck to keel, and 6 feet from beam to beam, the Mulch was designed to carry one crew member and two G7E torpedoes on port and starboard racks to depths of 120 feet and distances up to 50 nautical miles at a maximum submerged speed of 3 knots, a moderate walking pace. As an offensive weapon, the Mulch, like most of Germany's other midget subs, was largely unsuccessful. It was hard to steer, almost impossible to dive, and with a range so limited, it was dependent upon auxiliary vessels for support and deployment.
"Are you sure, Sam?" Remy asked.
"I'm sure. Everything fits."
"How in the world did it end up here?"
"That's the part that doesn't fit. According to everything I've read, these things only saw action in Holland, Denmark, Norway, and the Mediterranean. There are absolutely no records of Molches being deployed this far west."
"How many of these things were there?"
"Almost 400, and most of those were lost, either sunk or vanished. They were death traps, Remy. Only crazy men volunteered for midget sub-duty."
"You said a one-man crew."
"You don't think?" "Won't know until I get in there."
"And that other lovely word you used, torpedo."
"That's the dicey part. My hunch is it got pushed this far upriver by 6+ decades of storm surges. Probably both the torpedoes, if it was equipped with any to start with, were knocked off long ago."
"Well,
that's some small comfort," Remy replied. "Except for the unlucky fisherman who manages to snag one someday." "We're going to have to tell somebody about this. The Coast Guard or the Navy. How they'll deal with it, I have no idea."
"One thing at a time."
"Right. Step one. Make sure it isn't sitting atop a pair of 60-year-old live torpedoes."